This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, even if your original hometown doesn't even exist anymore, as we'll hear today, there are men and women around you who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and they have gone through things you and I have a hard time understanding or even imagining. And I think our eyes will be open today as we listen to the story of Dick Reiber, 93 years old, originally from the state of Georgia. He lives now in Kingsburg, California. In fact, if you ever stop by Valcommon Village, you'll have to say hi to Dick and his wife of 72 years, Lois. We're going to find out how they met. We're going to find out how he survived the Battle of the Bulge, because I'm not sure he thought he would for some really hairy moments there. But let's start early on. You grew up in a place that I guess isn't on the map anymore, Reeves, Georgia?
Actually, I was born in Reeves because my grandmother lived there at the time. Mother went home to have me.
All right.
Because her mother was a, sort of a midwife.
All right.
Didn't live there more than 6 months before we moved on.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it was shortly after that that Dad moved to Kansas. Town name of Hoisington, Kansas. It's up in north central Kansas. At that time, Dad was working on the railroad.
All right. And you had a couple brothers and a sister, and Reiber's a German name. Your grandfather had come over from Stuttgart a generation before. What was your childhood like? What kinds of things did you guys do?
Yeah, going to school, and like I said, we moved to Kansas. We lived there about 4 years. My younger brother was born there. He was not quite 4 years younger than myself. Best part of 2 years later, we moved back to Florida because Dad's job in the railroad there in Hoisington played out. He used to be a boilermaker. That was the guy that got crawled inside of a steam locomotive and repaired all the tubes in there that generated the steam, the fire. So it was kind of a rough job.
I guess so. And all these folks who probably have followed Purdue University for years and wondered, what's that nickname, the Boilermaker? What does that all mean? You just explained it to them. You did them a favor. And this is during the Great Depression. So I'm sure that finding jobs was not easy for your father.
Correct.
What was it like growing up during the Depression? Because, you know, you hear a lot of talk about the economy these days and through recent years, but it seems like it can't hold a candle to what you folks went through back in the 30s.
I believe that.
What was the hardest thing for you?
That's very difficult to pin down something real hard. We just lived.
You didn't know any different.
We didn't know any different. That pins it down. We knew that we didn't have a lot of money all the time. In fact, I remember one high school year while we were still living near this town of Collegedale. The only pair of shoes I had to wear to work to school was an old pair of my mother's shoes that had an inch heel on them, but I wore them because they fit my feet. Then we moved around several other places. We moved up near Crossville, Tennessee for a few months, and then shortly after that, Dad moved to the West Coast, and Mother followed him. And in the meantime, she'd gotten me a job working in a hospital over on the edge of Kentucky, and due to the fact that I'd had a bad fall as a two-year-old, my nose was badly out of shape.
Hmm.
And so she got me into that hospital because she knew the head man over there. And he had some work done on my nose. They didn't get it perfect, but then the bone structure of the nose is awful difficult to rearrange perfectly.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, it looks pretty good at 93.
Well,
and the Germans almost blew it off your face, so yeah, I think it looks really good.
They got close, but I've got a couple of scars here on this arm too. That
we'll get to that. I want to get to that at the Battle of the Bulge. So you go to this hospital, you're working there, and they fix your nose for you. And what happened
then,
next?
Then folks arranged to get me back to from Tennessee, clear back to California in the Los Angeles area in Glendale. Well, Dad's job in the L.A. area played out because the job he had depended on a supply of cheap steel from Belgium. And no more, So he had to go find them more work. He moved and went up to Oregon, west of Salem, and worked with my mother's brother, who was running a logging and sawmill operation up there.
All right.
I followed him. I hitchhiked out, and that's where the Army got me 6 or 9 months later. I remember that at the time, the thought of the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. For a time there, I was going out on a night watch where we were keeping watch for the possible Japanese planes to attack Oregon.
So up in Oregon, I've heard a lot of folks from California, especially on the coast. And, of course, the Japanese sub did shell Santa Barbara, as folks may know. But San Francisco was on blackouts. L.A. was on blackouts. So you're up here in Oregon, and you're not even on the coast, right?
Well, we were only less than 100 miles from the coast.
Right.
Salem is not much over 100 miles from the coast, and we were 20 miles or so west of Salem.
So there was a concern that the Japanese would be bombing Oregon.
There was a concern that we should be able to keep track of any aircraft in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember being on a day shift, mostly at night, because they figured they would be a night shift.
So what would you do? Where'd you go?
I don't recall much about what we went to, but I do know that there would be two or three people to keep each other awake and be available to the phone. So if we heard an aircraft, anything sound like an aircraft, we could get on the phone to somebody in authority.
Was that kind of nerve-wracking work or not so much?
Well, after the first day, there were no airplanes. I never heard of an airplane while I was on duty there. I mean, planes were scarce then.
Sure, sure.
And no airlines going over every half hour.
Right. So it was a whole lot of hurry up and wait for nothing, huh?
A whole lot of hurry up and wait. But we didn't really regard it as nothing because we were doing what we thought they wanted done.
And you were getting paid for it?
No.
Oh, this is volunteer.
It was totally a volunteer.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if somebody else might have gotten paid for it, but I didn't.
Well, Uncle Sam would eventually be paying for you because he told you that you had to go to work for him after you turned 21 in August of 1942. What did that feel like to be drafted into the Army?
Actually, I was hadn't quite turned 21 when they took me in.
Oh, okay.
Went up to Fort Lewis.
Uh-huh.
I got outfitted, and then they said they were sending me down to Camp Roberts for basic training. The fall of 42, late summer and fall, I took basic training down in Camp Roberts.
Which is still there.
Which
and
is still
in
there.
In fact, they listen to this show every weekend over at Camp Roberts.
Something I didn't mention was I was pretty good at guessing the right answers.
All right.
Mechanically. So up at Fort Lewis, when they first took us in, then they always gave a bunch of paperwork.
Right.
And I blew the hell out of their mechanical aptitude test. Yeah. They told me I was way up above everybody else. Nothing came of it. They needed people carrying a gun worse than they needed mechanics then.
I guess so. And you heard about the paratroopers?
Well, I was taking basic. Mm-hmm. We heard about them several times. I thought, well, why not try for it? The thought of using a parachute didn't scare me.
Right.
So they shipped me down to Fort Benning. You have heard Fort Benning referred to before now?
I've talked to a lot of guys who trained there and had to go up those giant jump towers from the World's Fair, you bet.
I was told that Fort Benning was where they trained all the infantry officers.
They did have OCS there, yeah.
And that they had a title for them then. Fort Benning idiots. Because there was so much about being a second lieutenant.
Right.
That you don't get just in a few weeks school. You got to get out there and live it a while.
You're talking about the 90-day wonders?
Yeah. They said some polite way to say it was 90-day wonders.
And the impolite way was Fort Benning idiots.
Yeah.
Because they'd get out of OCS and thought they knew it all and then get into battle and find out they didn't? Is that the gist of it?
They didn't even make it to battle before they found that out. They got sent to a training unit.
Uh-huh.
But since some kind of bug bit me after I'd been down there a couple of weeks, I was in the hospital for about, best part of a week. So they said, maybe you're not for jump school. We'll send you to Fort Bragg, where they're training the glider regiments. How about that? I said, it's all the same to me. It's still the same uniform.
It wasn't disappointing to you that you had gone to Fort Benning hoping to be a paratrooper and then got sick?
Not really. I did have one interesting experience there. This guy, he wasn't near as big as I am, but he was in charge of lecturing to us about a superior training that the paratroopers got.
Yeah.
There was a group over there. They were wearing fatigue uniforms with fabric officer bars on them. And I saw one of them smiling real big when the class instructor asked for volunteers. He got out there. I guess he thought he was pretty good at that hand-to-hand stuff. You know, that little guy about two-thirds his size seemed like just turned him every which way loose. He really demonstrated what he was talking about when he said that that training made a superior fighter out of him.
Mm-hmm.
So I got sent over to Fort Bragg and eventually to Camp McCall in North Carolina.
So you're training with glider infantry now. It'd be a similar situation. You're taken in behind enemy lines, but instead of parachuting out of the plane, the idea is the glider's going to land you.
The idea was with the glider, yes. But they decided the mortality rate amongst gliders was just too high to attempt to use them in most combat situations. That some certain combat situations, yes, they might be useful, but the drop in from a parachute was better because you were a much smaller target. During the course of training at Fort Bragg, they eventually sent us up to South Dakota. Somebody had looked up the record and saw what I'd done to that mechanical aptitude test. They thought I'd make a good engineer.
All right.
I know now that part of my trouble is I've had sleep apnea all my life.
Huh.
And it interferes with learning when I'm sitting in a chair. So I flunked that after 3 months. But in the meantime, as a weekend activity, I discovered that the town of Madison, where they had sent me, Madison University.
So they'd sent you to the University of Wisconsin to train in engineering?
Yeah.
Okay.
I discovered that somebody had put up a tent out there over a floor and made a roller skating rink.
All right.
Well, I could more or less stand up on skates. I couldn't fancy skate at all. But I decided to go out there and enjoy it on a Saturday night. I'd get weekend passes because we didn't have any classes then.
Uh-huh.
That's where I met my wife.
Yeah, good thing you went over to that tent to roller skate. Tell me how you met her. What was that meeting like?
Well, actually, she and a friend of hers, Lois could stand up on skates pretty good.
Yeah.
But a friend of hers couldn't.
Uh-huh.
So I cut in. Here, I'm big shot. I'm going to have fun with this gal teaching her, helping her learn to roller skate.
You're trying to help Lois's friend?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Going home that night, apparently the friend bragged so much about Dick this and Dick that that Lois decided she'd cut in and find out what happened. And she wound up 72 years later here.
So she saw the attention you paid this other friend. She said, I got to check this guy out. So then the next time at the roller rink, she cuts in on you? And
well, the next time, yeah.
What'd and you think? What'd you think of her?
I decided I preferred her company to the other girl,
uh-huh.
And she seemed to like it. So before I got shipped out of there, we went down to City Hall and got a marriage license and got married.
How long after you met did you get married?
A little bit longer than a month, probably 6 weeks.
You met her, and 6 weeks later you were married?
Yeah.
There must have been something real special about her.
Well, I thought so at the time.
How do you feel about it now, 72 years later?
I'm still here.
Yes, you are.
Doesn't that kind of speak for itself?
And she's still here. And you didn't come back quite the same as you went over. So that
True.
Speaks to her as well.
True.
So you get married, and then they ship you overseas?
No, actually, I went back and spent another 6 months, I guess, altogether.
Uh-huh.
With the basic outfit I'd been with, the glider regiment. And a couple weeks later, they shipped me to England.
Was it hard? Did you get to say goodbye to Lois?
In a way, Yes, because we just barely had gotten together again.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to go overseas and wonder if you'd ever see her again?
I don't remember it as being a really intense emotion, but it was there. It was a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What were you expecting when you went overseas?
I figured I'd be reassigned to some. I was not part of a company, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I was a signee.
Right.
To be shipped in and blended into some other company there.
Well, we'll have to follow that part of the story when we come back. What was it that caused Dick Reiber to miss Operation Market Garden? How did he end up at the Battle of the Bulge? And, of course, we'll get to that moment that nearly ended his life. If you pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook, you'll find a video of Dick explaining and pointing out the injuries for which he received the Purple Heart. We're going to jump right back into his story when Hometown Heroes continues after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.